Hello everyone, and welcome back to Strange Origins. My name's Paige, and this week I want to give a special shout out to my friend Josh, who suggested this week's topic. I want to note that while I will be delving into the history of specific haunted houses in the future, such as the Winchester Mystery House, I thought it would be good to introduce everyone to the basic history of the concept, since it's something not a lot of people know the origin of. Haunted houses. You either love them or you hate them. There's really no in between. Personally, I used to hate haunted houses. While my friends would scare themselves at sleepovers watching films like Stephen King's 1408, I preferred to watch cartoons downstairs. That was until my first year of college. My roommates put on The Conjuring, and I can still remember peeking through my fingers to watch as a body dropped down from the ceiling in the basement of the Perrin farmhouse. If that wasn't alarming enough, it then slowly, mechanically, began to turn around to face the person stuck down there alone. If you want to know what happened next, you'll just have to watch the film for yourself. While the movie scared me to death when I first saw it, it's become my favorite horror film, and one that I suggest to people when they ask what to watch when first diving into the horror genre. Now I feel as if I've seen every film with a haunted house in it. I've even delved into the literature side of things, and am currently reading The Haunting of Hill House by Shirley Jackson. I also often watch YouTube channels of urban explorers who visit abandoned homes and buildings, such as The Proper People or Dan Bell. Though these channels state that they don't believe in ghosts, it's still fun to watch and see if any weird events take place. So, what exactly makes a house haunted? According to Wikipedia, a haunted house is, quote, a house or building that is perceived to be inhabited by disembodied spirits of the deceased who may have been former residents, or were otherwise connected to the property, end quote. One might imagine a neighborhood of different homes when trying to put their finger on the ideal haunted house. I personally love the image of a spooky Victorian mansion, such as Disney's The Haunted Mansion or the Simmons Mansion from The Ghost of Mr. Chicken. Or more real-life examples, such as the Franklin Castle in Cleveland, Ohio. My first experience with falling in love with a haunted house was with the Art Nouveau style of Whipstaff Manor, the one featured in the 1995 Casper. You might have had similar experiences with other film sets, such as the farmhouse style of the Beetlejuice home or the Whidbey Island Victorian from Practical Magic, though that was only shortly inhabited by a spirit. Other famous examples of houses in film and literature that you might recognize include the Allerdale Hall from Crimson Peak, Zorba Mansion from 13 Ghosts, the Stone English Manor from The Others or Eel Marsh from The Black Lady, the Dutch Colonial Revival from Amityville Horror, Windward House from The Uninvited, which I might add has created in me a hatred of cherub decor, or the Bly Country Estate from The Innocents, all the way up to what is referred to as the Mount Everest of haunted houses, the Belasco home from The Legend of Hell House. Just to clarify, these are all very European or Americanized versions of a haunted house, though in later episodes I will be delving into different cultures' definitions of a haunted house, such as Japanese ghost stories, which in itself is probably an hour-long episode of spooky stuff. For the sake of time, though, I wanted to focus on the history of just a few houses, and also get into where it all started. I want to answer the question of what the first few haunted houses looked like in literature, and how the idea of a haunted house evolved over time to help symbolize the mental state of those that inhabit it. Stick with me after this very short break to hear more. Welcome back, everyone. Places like Casa Loma in Canada, Wolf Manor in California, Sweetwater Mansion in Alabama, Port Arthur, Australia, Chateau de Brissac in France, and Corvin Castle in Romania have been reportedly quote-unquote haunted for quite some time now. But where did this fascination begin? According to the history books, the first recorded haunted house was reported in 75 AD in Athens, Greece. These events were put down to paper by Pliny the Younger, who was a lawyer, a magistrate, and luckily enough for us, an author. He wrote hundreds of letters, of which 247 survive to this day. They were to and about other people, which I'm guessing means that he was a rather popular gossip. According to Pliny, in a letter to a patron of his, there was a villa in Athens that no one wanted to rent until philosopher Athenodorus came to town and needed cheap lodgings. The first night of his stay, a ghost with a very long beard in the form of an old man appeared to him in chains. He said that it lured him to the courtyard outside of the house and disappeared mysteriously. Athenodorus marked the spot where it had vanished, and the next day he ordered that the ground be dug up. Unsurprisingly, he found the bones of an old man in chains. When they gave the bones a proper burial somewhere else, the ghost was never seen again. About 800 years later, the first experience with a poltergeist was recorded. While still considered a type of ghost, a poltergeist is more of a malevolent spirit that causes physical disturbances. In this particular case, a German farmhouse was the site of thrown objects and randomly started fires. The 1800 years since have been filled with haunted house stories from around the world. Which leads me to my next question. Seeing as haunted houses in film and literature are all pretty much alike in style, where did the stereotype come from? According to books, the image originated with a little Gothic novel from 1764 called The Castle of Otranto. It was written by Horace Walpole, humanitarian, man of letters, and antiquarian, who was the youngest son of the first British Prime Minister. Ironically, Walpole had a self-proclaimed hatred of superstition, but at the same time, he is to blame for a lot of aspects of Gothic literature that in the end became standard, including the love of all things spooky. He is also famed for building the famous Strawberry Hill in Twickenham, London, and for bringing back the medieval Gothic style decades before the Victorians ran with it, leading to things like penny dreadfuls and seance sessions. While Strawberry Hill did have a printing press of its own, which meant that they were ridiculously wealthy at the time, Horace anonymously wrote The Castle of Otranto and had it published elsewhere due to the fact that supernatural writers at the time were not taken seriously. In the novel preface, which is now considered a sort of manifesto for the Gothic genre as a whole, it stated that the author, quote, sought to restore the qualities of imagination and invention to contemporary fiction, end quote. In other words, he saw that literature was lacking in the medieval-style, romantic, emotionally driven plotlines that would become incredibly popular a century after his own death. While extremely complicated, I'll do my best to give you a rundown of The Castle of Otranto. It's a medieval-style novel that follows the current king of the Castle of Otranto, whose name is Manfred. On the day of his sickly son's wedding to a princess that will garner Manfred political alliances, a helmet falls out of nowhere and hits his son on the head, killing him. It's suggested with this random event that the castle may be haunted, but throughout the next few events, it's proven. Manfred, after the death of his son, remembers a prophecy about the end of his family's bloodline that states that the name Otranto and the title of lordship were to be succeeded by another family when, quote, the real owner should be grown too large to inhabit it, end quote. In an attempt to stop the end of his bloodline, he divorces his wife and attempts to marry the young Princess Isabella, seeing as she is young and can bear more children for him. When Manfred proposes this idea to the princess, she rightfully refuses. When Manfred walks closer to her with evil intent, the ghost of Manfred's grandfather appears, helping the princess to escape. She flees with the help of a servant, and when Manfred finds out, he orders the death of that servant. After an incident where the servant turns out to be the long-lost son of the man who was ordered to kill him, Manfred finds out that the knights from Princess Isabella's kingdom are there to rescue her. Following a few plot twists, the man who helped the princess to escape, whose name is Theodore, fights one of the knights, who turns out to be Isabella's father. After a short tussle, they all decide to go back to the castle to work things out. Well, it gets pretty confusing after that, with stories of the ghosts of hermits living in the forest, warning against a double marriage. It ends as one would expect, in both tragedy and triumph. After Manfred begins to suspect Isabella of meeting with the slave Theodore, he ends up stabbing his own daughter, who he mistook for Isabella. After a large part of the castle crumbles, the ghost of one of the past owners of the castle is revealed and tells everyone that Manfred is not his heir, and that Manfred's grandfather poisoned the true lord of the castle years ago and didn't tell anyone. Instead, Theodore, the slave who took up arms against the evil Manfred, is the true owner of the castle and lord of the land. When Manfred could have not meddled and saved his family through the alliance of his daughter and Theodore, he ruined everything with his hubris. In the end, Manfred fulfilled the prophecy of his own demise. It makes sense when you realize that Walpole was very much influenced by Shakespeare's Hamlet, whose story also features a haunted castle. The novel became popular and laid the groundwork for a plethora of creepy gothic novels to come in the next few decades that involved the supernatural. We have Walpole to thank for modern staples such as Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, Bram Stoker's Dracula, in the novels of Anne Radcliffe and Edgar Allan Poe. The notion of clanking chains, creaking doors, the appearance of ghosts and hidden staircases and tunnels would forever be associated with haunted houses due to the capital R romanticism of Horace Walpole. A century later, in The Turn of the Screw, the 1898 novel by Henry James, a lot of these classic characteristics would be employed. First, you have the setting, which is a large summer estate in the English countryside. Secondly, you have isolation, which is paramount as the characters need to have no one to talk to when experiencing strange events, so that they can play down the sights or sounds of the haunting. Thirdly, you need a reason for the character to need to stay in that particular location. In The Turn of the Screw, it's the fact that the governess is the only person in the children's lives, as they are orphaned. They depend on her for everything, including a safe environment. And lastly, you have a lot of strange incidences that are a hallmark of any haunted house movie, such as creepy shapes watching you sleep, things going missing, unexplained cuts or bruises, and extreme paranoia and discourse. When you throw a mixture of these things together, you've got yourself a pretty solid haunted house story. In real life, though, it's a little different. In real estate, mention of a house being haunted can often lead to reduced pricing and buyer's regret. Something about living in a haunted house doesn't really allow people to relax. But for entertainment purposes, people will spend big bucks for a short stay at hotels or attractions that are labeled as haunted. Haunted houses don't always have to be a house, though. They can take the shape of many different facilities, such as lighthouses, hotels, castles, or even ships. The Queen Mary is a ship that now acts as a hotel after years of catering to celebrities such as Elizabeth Taylor and Audrey Hepburn in the early 20th century. After a short stint acting as a World War II troop ship with the name the Grey Ghost, ironically, the ship is reported today to be haunted. The most famous stories of ghost encounters are of a man who was crushed to death in a large metal door and a crew member who was murdered in room B340. Another example of a haunted house that isn't your conventional house is Trans-Allegheny in West Virginia. A former lunatic asylum, Trans-Allegheny is reported to be one of the most haunted spots in America. In the early 20th century, thousands suffering from a range of things such as mild depression to drug addiction, to those that were, quote, non-educatable mental defectives, unquote, lived years of their lives there. Quite a few died there too, which makes sense when you hear all the stories that have come out of it in the past 50 years. While it was built to house around 240 patients, leaving plenty of room for fresh air and daylight to help the patients with recovery, It ended up housing about 2,400 people at a time. It was a home for a lot of people during their lifetime, whether for the best or not. Today you can pay to take daytime ghost tours of former asylums such as Trans-Allegheny, where you can attempt to catch a ghost on film and learn about the history of the place. Another place that we don't often like to refer to as a home is a prison. Eastern State Penitentiary in Philadelphia is very famous for being a place where men ate, slept, and lived. Sadly, it's filled with plenty of tragic backstory. While built with humanitarian intentions, much like Trans-Allegheny, the history of the prison is an especially horrible one. Originally created as a way for prisoners to live in isolation to further contemplate their penance and come out better than they were before, the lack of socialization experienced by the inmates was later considered to be closer to extreme mental torture rather than a form of rehabilitation. They were kept in solitary confinement every moment of their sentence, with the exception of seeing guards every now and then. Even when they were allowed outside for fresh air and exercise, they were not allowed to talk to each other and had to keep hoods on, avoiding eye contact at all times. While the owners of the building today don't state that the place is haunted, there have still been reports of strange noises, darting shadows, and faces coming out of nowhere. Another facet of haunted places that fascinates me are ghost towns. In the west of the United States, they are littered everywhere, reminders of past booms and subsequent failures of industrial enterprises. One of my favorite ghost towns is Bannock, Montana. Firstly, it's my favorite because I have a lot of great memories of going there with friends. Secondly, it's been pretty preserved since its creation as a gold rush town in 1862, from when its last residents left a century later. Hotel Mead, which I will be sure to feature pictures of on my Instagram, is the largest structure and has been reported to have plenty of ghosts walking through its halls. Dorothy Dunn, a teenager who supposedly drowned in a dredge pond, has been frequently seen. She is known to wear a blue dress and can be seen in the upstairs window of the hotel, looking down at passerbys. A child who visited the town with their family once reported that Dorothy had tried to talk to her, but that they couldn't understand what she was trying to say as she kept moving her lips with no words coming out, almost as if she was underwater. One last thing I would like to note is that in literature, it's also fairly common that haunted houses are used to personify what's going on with the characters, giving them a way to tell the reader of traumatic or abusive events that have happened to them. The image of a haunted house doesn't exactly mean the literal ghosts are involved. In the novel and film Psycho, the Second Empire Victorian-style motel, simply referred to as Bates Motel, is only seen as haunted due to the creepy actions of its owner. People often forget that no real ghosts actually existed inside the house. It's simply only Norman Bates' twisted sense of reality that exists. In The Haunting of Hill House, drug addiction, sexual abuse, and mental illnesses are all assigned to their own ghosts as a form of personification. For some reason, it helps characters to be able to blame parts of their personality or events on ghosts, instead of facing reality. The opposite is also true, where things are blamed on mental illnesses acting up or a character going on a binge, when ghosts were involved all along. I've also recently noticed that quite a few horror films these days are advertised as paranormal, when in reality the twist is that the only thing haunting the houses are memories of abusive relationships or traumatic events. This was very obvious in movies such as 2011's Silent House, which I would not recommend to anyone with an abusive past. Most of the time in haunted house stories, though, houses are just a daily reminder of something traumatic that has happened in the past. They wait patiently for someone to discover the truth of the past and set things straight again. In the 1980 version of The Changeling, and also in The Woman in Black, it's the death of a young boy that sets off a series of events. Men who live in the beautiful mansions in these films are forced to discover long-hidden truths about how young boys were lied to or murdered in cold blood, leading the main characters on a life-changing quest to make things right. Another thing that I've noticed is that the way a human body works is often used as a way to describe how a haunted house exists. If you've ever seen the 2006 children's movie Monster House, then you get what I'm talking about. This is why a lot of haunted house stories mention that there is usually one specific room that acts as the heart or the brain of the operation, luring people in and consuming them much like a stomach would. A great example of this would be in the posters for Netflix's Haunting of Hill House. The windows of the home are used to replace the eyes of the youngest member of the Crane family in the poster. She is the house, and the house is her. It consumes her thoughts, and the house wishes only to consume her. This makes even more sense when you realize that the house has a room with a small window that can be seen throughout the series that is used by different members of the family for their own purposes. This red room is considered the stomach of the house, where the activity stems from and where a lot of terrifying and life-altering events take place. It's not a ghost that wishes to lure people in this example, but rather the house itself, which is somehow hungry. In reality, though, places like the haunted Cahoe House in Georgia are simply just that, haunted. It was the spot of a few unsubstantiated deaths of children, which a majority of homes were in the 1800s, seeing as the death rate for children was much higher at the time. And it also served as a funeral home, which a lot of houses also did, seeing as they more frequently held wakes in the past. And the occurrence of dead bodies staying inside the home for several days was pretty normal. Overall, though, the house had a fairly normal history. For one reason or another, though, the house is a gathering space for spirits, or says those that have witnessed ghosts at the house. Maybe the owners are nice to them. Maybe the house exists on a ley line. Maybe they're like me and the gorgeous architecture is what keeps them around. I could guess all day as to why a place is haunted, but really the reasons for haunted houses are often not explainable. But as long as they respect your space, it's really just best that you respect theirs. It was most likely their home too once, and you're really in all reality a visitor, just as they were. So don't freak out too much the next time you see someone in period clothing walking down your hallway. They probably just forgot their jacket upstairs, or something mundane like that. Before the conclusion of this episode, I feel responsible to put out a disclaimer. A lot of experiences that may lead one to believe that they are living in a haunted house can easily be explained away. Before jumping to any conclusions and phoning your local priest to bless your home, be sure that things such as creaky pipes or old wood aren't the cause of spooky noises. And if you've seen or heard things that you just can't quite explain, visual and auditory hallucinations are often caused by slow leaks of carbon monoxide, so be sure to call a professional if something seems off to you. The sensed presence effect is also a pretty common reason for the belief that a house is haunted. This effect was even experienced by explorers in Antarctic explorations in 1901. Due to stressful events and physical exhaustion, which a lot of you out there may be dealing with, members of the group would often count one more explorer than was actually there. While others blamed it on the presence of an angel or a ghost, science gives it the name of the sensed presence effect. So stay safe out there, and learn the difference between hallucinations and the spirit of your grandma visiting. The best advice I can give you about discerning the difference is that 99.99% of the time, the spirits that decide to visit you are really looking out for you. They're nice. Anything else is usually something that you'll need to dig deeper into. Generally speaking, if you stay away from Ouija boards and satanic films, it's probably just Casper the Friendly Ghost popping in for a visit. So, be welcome. Now, as I come to the end of this episode, I want to thank anyone that took the time to listen, and also to thank my sponsor, Anchor.fm, for allowing me to get this podcast out for you all to hear. For anyone that has a story they would like to share, I would absolutely love to be able to hear from you, wherever you are and whoever you are. It would be great to know what about this week's topic interested you, if you have your own experiences with it, or if you have suggestions as to what would make this podcast better. I would also love to be able to read your stories aloud on the podcast so that listeners know that they aren't alone in their experiences. I'm working on building an Instagram page for Strange Origins, so if you like what you hear or you like spooky memes, go give me a follow. Also, if you would like to support this podcast and to help it grow into something bigger, please visit my Patreon page, which is listed in the description of this episode, and where I offer great gifts to those supporting my dream job. And as always, guys, remember to keep it strange.